Okay, welcome. We are going to finish Genesis today. We left our hero in Genesis 39. And in Genesis 39, verse 20, the last time we saw our hero Joseph, he was in prison for a crime that he did not commit. It says in verse 20, Joseph's master took him, put him in the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were bound, and he was there in the prison. But then from the end of that verse to the end of the chapter, just a couple of verses, we read that the Lord's with him. Look what it says in verse 21. The Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners that were in the prison, and whatsoever they did there, he was the doer of it. The keeper of the prison looked not to anything that was under his hand, because the Lord was with him, and that which he did, the Lord made it to prosper. And so essentially, even though Joseph is in the bottom of the pit, he's in the symbolic sense of being a representation or a type of Christ, this is essentially where Jesus is in Sheol. He is in the spirit world, and his body's in the tomb. This is Joseph in the belly of the earth. He's in the tomb of the earth. He is in this dungeon. He's in this prison. And essentially, even in this darkest situation, the Lord is with him. And so we know the story, right? We've seen the musical. And so in the 40th chapter, this is the story of the butler and the baker and their dreams that they have. And if you can't remember it, it's okay. Just know that it's the butler who's going to live and the baker, not so much. And they both have this dream, and you can read it, or you should read it in the 40th chapter. But they come to Joseph and say, can you interpret this dream? And so the butler gets the good news, the baker gets the bad news. And essentially Joseph asks the butler, hey, when you go back to the Pharaoh, will you let him know about me? And the butler's like, you bet, not a problem. And of course he forgets. And so Joseph spends a lot of time in prison. We don't really know how long Joseph is in prison, but it's probably somewhere in around ballpark, around 10 years. We read that he's 30 in verse 46 of Genesis 41, that he's 30 when he stands before Pharaoh. And we know that he is turned over to the slave traders when he's 17. So I think 10 years is a good estimate, but it could be 12. It could be, you know, we really don't know. But essentially, he's in prison for quite some time. And so that's the end of the 40th chapter, where essentially the chief butler forgets him. And then so we get to the 41st chapter, and this is the story where the Pharaoh has the dream of the 7 fat cows and the 7 skinny cows. And the skinny ones eat up the fat ones. And the butler comes to him and says, you know, hey, I think I know this guy that he can hook us up. So it says in verse 9, the chief butler went to the Pharaoh and he said, I do remember my faults this day. You know, you put me in prison. But there was this guy, verse 12, a young man, a Hebrew servant to the captain of the guard. And we told him our dreams and he interpreted them. And so Pharaoh calls him. And so he comes, and that's in verse 14, him coming to the Pharaoh, and it says, Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon. So that's the pit, as it were. And he shaved himself and changed his raiment and came in unto Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I dreamed a dream. That's a cognate accusative, right? Where the verb is describing the subject as well, dreaming a dream. And there is none that can interpret it. And Joseph said to Pharaoh, it is not me, but God will give you an answer of peace. And so he gives the credit to God. And so there's the exchange of, hey, this is what happened in the dream. And then Joseph tells him, you know what this is? We're going to have 7 good years. And then we're going to have 7 years where it's going to be really rough. And so that starts in verse 25 of the 41st chapter. Verse 26 says, the 7 good kine or good cow are 7 years, and the 7 good ears are 7 years. The 7 thin and ill-favored kind that came up after them are 7 years, and the 7 empty ears of corn, as it were, blasted with the east wind, are 7 years of famine. Now, a couple of thoughts really quick on corn. There probably was no corn in the Middle East at this time. The word for corn is sheber, or sometimes it's bar, and it essentially just means grain. And not to get too technical, but you can say that. You can say any kind of grain. In the English language, corn can be wheat or barley or rye. And so it's not necessarily a bad word to use, but I think modern readers read it and they're like, so are there ears of corn? Are we reading about you know, the corn that we're going to have corn on the cob? And the answer to me is, well, probably not. Now, if you want to geek out on this, they actually found corn, strong evidence for it in the Asian continent way before Columbus. And I'll post this in the show notes for those of you that want to nerd out on it, but it really doesn't matter. Like, I don't really care. But just know that this is grain. And so the word in the Hebrew is going to be grain. A lot of the translators, they just call it grain. And so essentially he tells them, hey, we're going to have 7 good years. We're going to have 7 rough years. And so then there's this big discussion. Well, what should we do? And he says, well, what we've got to do, verse 34, is gather a fifth during the good years and save it. Put it in store, verse 36. Verse 37, the Pharaoh's like, that is a really good idea. Man, we got to get a guy that we can put in charge. And Pharaoh says, I know, let's do you. Verse 39, there is none so discreet and wise as thou art. And so Pharaoh essentially is going to put Joseph in charge. And to me, I see a lot of this as the hero's journey, as the success, the kingship coming into the throne. This is also riddled with temple symbolism and imagery. This is also the promise in Revelation chapter 3, where Jesus says this. And I really like this, where Jesus says, verse 20 of Revelation 3, behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come to him and I will sup with him. That's eat. And he will, and he with me. To him that overcometh will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I overcame and am set down with my Father in his throne. This is theosis. This is also called divinization. This is the idea that man can partake of all that the Father has. This is section 84, where the Lord says essentially, all that the Father hath will be given unto those who are faithful. And so in this story, this is a historical story, it's a historical narrative, but I'm just going to wax a little bit typological here. The Pharaoh is going to represent God. He is the sovereign over all the land, and he's going to make Joseph his number two, to quote the musical. In essence, this is Jesus saying to us, everything that my Father has, I will give to you if you're faithful. And so Joseph, after being faithful for all these years in prison, verse 40, is given rulership. It says, thou shalt rule, or thou shalt be over my house. According to thy word shall all my people be ruled. Only in the throne will I be greater than thou. The word for rule is a very interesting word, and it's neshak. And it's used 35 times in the Old Testament, and typically it's used this is very interesting, it's used to give a kiss. Very interesting. So this is an embrace, as it were. So the translators translate this as rule or be over, but the word is a very interesting word, like I said. It can also mean to be in close contact or to be joined together. If you move the vowel points around, and the vowel points are what really change the meaning of the word. And so neshak is three consonants. It's nun, shin, kof. And if you change the vowel points, and it sounds like neshek, it's arms or weaponry, and it can also mean to be close. And so modern translators just translate this as rule. Quick history on the vowel pointing system. There were no vowel points in the early texts of Genesis. These were added later by a group of people called the Masoretes. And they did this in order to preserve the meaning of the text, because people were not speaking and reading Hebrew. And they knew that this language that had all these consonants and no vowels had to be written in such a way that people could read it and understand the vowels and how it worked. And so they added these vowel points later. And this is around 600 years after Jesus. And so who knows? Maybe this is an idea, neshek or neshak. It could be to kiss, or it could be to have weapons over, or ownership over, or military might. You know, modern translators have gone with rule over. But I find that interesting, especially in the context of this being a temple text. The word neshak, to kiss, is associated with an embrace. And especially in the Egyptian rituals, coming unto God ended in an embrace, where the God gave you the power over his house, and he gave you a name and keys and the right to rule. And so to me, I see some of that happening here. But like I said, that's just me nerding out on one word. Nevertheless, I see temple all over this stuff, because look what happens next. Verse 41, Pharaoh said, I have set thee over all the land of Egypt. So he's given land. Think about the Abrahamic covenant, right? Priesthood, posterity, and property. Verse 42, Pharaoh takes off his ring and he puts it on Joseph's hand. And then it says, he arrayed him in vestures of fine linen. Now, the linen of the Egyptians was white. The Hebrews typically wore wool, which many of the Egyptians looked at kind of gross. They didn't really look at that as refined. And especially those that were wealthy wore, and they were very particular about their hygiene, but they wore white linen. And so here's the imagery. I'm going to give you rulership. I'm going to give you the ring of authority. I'm going to give you white linen and a gold chain, verse 42. And he made him to ride in the second chariot, which he had, and they cried before him, bow the knee, and he made him ruler over all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without thee shall no man lift up his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paneah, and then he gave him the wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipherah, priest of On, and Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. And Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. A couple thoughts. Jesus' public ministry, he's 30. More. Everyone has to bow the knee. Notice this verse. This verse is Philippians chapter 2, and this in scholarship is called catabasis, or the going down the staircase. So we're going to talk about Jesus in Philippians 2, and I'm going to tie this into Joseph. Look at verse 5. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. Philippians 2, verse 6. Who, meaning Jesus, being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but, here he goes down the staircase, verse 7. He, Jesus, made himself of no reputation and took upon him the form of a servant and was made in the likeness of men. So God became man, Emmanuel, God with us. And being found in fashion as a man, he, meaning Jesus, humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. So he suffers a criminal's death, and his spirit goes to Sheol, and his body goes to the tomb. Now we're going to do anabasis. We're going to go up the staircase. Verse 9. Wherefore God has highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name. And at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow of things in heaven, things in earth, and things under the earth. And every tongue will confess that Jesus is Lord to the glory of God the Father. And so to the author of Philippians chapter 2, Jesus went down, 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 and then up all the way, and every knee shall bow. And I see that in Genesis 41, as everyone bows the knee to Joseph. And we're going to see this over and over again with the brothers. Then you get the name. He gets a wife, so that's tied into the seed. But then you get this new name, and this one's kind of puzzled scholars for years, like, what do we do with Zaphnath-Paneah? And so I'm just going to suggest one possibility, but I certainly don't know. But if you take the two words and you kind of break them out, because they really are two words, you get a four-character word in Hebrew, Zaphan, and then you get Panach. Both these are two words that have four characters each. And with Zaphan, you can get some interesting things. You get a zapa, which literally means covering. Another word that is associated with this is zipia, which is a lookout post. Or if you add the mem in front of it, you get the mishpeh, which is a watchtower. And so a lot of scholars look at this and say this new name could mean the person who reveals secrets. Well, what does a covering have to do with secrets? Well, then you get to the next word. The next word, panach, can mean a couple of things. One possibility is it could be the word for rest, which is where we get Noah's name, Noach. Another one could be to shine, which is yapa, which is kind of the center of that word. Or another one is yipa, which is brightness or splendor. Now, how can someone who is revealing secrets, what could brightness and covering have to do with revealing secrets? And that's where you get into some interesting things, especially if you get into the Greek. And so the word for truth in Greek is aletheia, and it's essentially an alpha attached to the word for hide or cover. Letho, or another way to say letho is lantheno, is the word for to hide or to cover. And so in the Greek, the idea of truth is we take away the covering. That A in front of it, that alpha in front of it, is an addition to the word, which means like the opposite or to remove it. And so literally the word for truth in the Greek idea is to remove the covering, to remove the veil. That's truth. Now think about this in a temple context and think about the name. We are shining light on the covering. We are giving brightness to the covering, or we're taking the covering and we're bringing out rest. All of these to me have temple meanings in a temple context. This idea of a veil or a covering and light and brightness and having it be revealed. To me, I see this name as indicative of who Joseph is. He's revealing that which is hidden. He has revealed to the Pharaoh the dream, the interpretation. He is also going to reveal to his brothers who he is when they come to get bread. He's also going to save them from death. And I think to me also he reveals that which is hidden in the sense that he shows us who Jesus is. And so I really like that new name, but I also submit to you that it's a little puzzling. And just because I give you these possibilities doesn't mean I'm right. I'm just kind of shedding some light on this. But nevertheless, he has this name and he's given this wife. And so he's going to rule and reign. And so it says in verse 49 that he gathers the corn, or as it were, the grain. And he has two sons. Their names are Manasseh and Ephraim. That's verse 51 and verse 52. And today in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, many members are descended from Ephraim. If you are descended from Ephraim, that ties you into Joseph, who then ties you into Israel, all the way back to Father Abraham. And so that is the family of Joseph. And notice verse 55, the people cried for bread, and it's Joseph who supplies it. And so there is another instance where this story is referring to Jesus Christ. He is the bread of life, and he is providing the bread to everyone that is just starving. And notice at the end of verse 57, the very last verse, all countries came into Egypt to buy corn because all the famine was so sore in all lands. And I like to say, and I even wrote this in my scriptures, everybody needs Jesus. All Israel needs Christ. And so that's the end of chapter 41. And it's setting us up for the first trip of the brothers. So the brothers are all the way in the land of Canaan. The famine's affecting everybody. And so they come down. And Joseph is going to have this experience where the word is shekah, they bow down. That's verse 6. And it's going to happen repeatedly over and over again. The author of Genesis in the 42nd chapter really wants you to know that the father sends everybody except Benjamin. He keeps him behind. And if you remember, just to recap, Benjamin and Joseph are the sons of Rachel. And Jacob's already lost Rachel. She's passed away. And he's lost Joseph. He thinks Joseph's dead, and so he's holding on to Benjamin. The author, I think, is trying to show you that Benjamin is this favorite son, and we're going to see in this narrative that the brothers have grown up. They're not these jealous brothers anymore from 12, 13 years ago, but they've matured, and they get their place, they get their station, and they know what they've done to their father. And so they come down. And I love verse 8 of chapter 42, where it says, Joseph knew his brethren, but they knew not him. Also verse 6, that he's the governor. And so they're bowing down to him, and he's speaking in a language that's not the Canaanite language or the Semitic language of the Hebrews. He's speaking to them in his language. And he calls them spies in verse 9. And there's some penning happening in 42:9 where it says, you are spies to see the nakedness of the land. This is reminiscent of Genesis 39:8-20, where Joseph is accused of seeing the wife of Potiphar, seeing her nakedness, which he was not guilty of, but he was condemned to a life in prison, or at least 10 to 12 years in prison, for a crime he didn't commit. And so there's some of this happening here where he says, you're here to see the nakedness of the land. And they say, no, we're all one man's sons. And then he's like, no, you're really here to see the nakedness of the land again, verse 12. And then they say, no, there's really 12 of us. And Joseph's like, really? I don't see 12. And they say, well, you know, one is left behind and one is not. That's verse 13. And so then this is what he says, verse 15. By the life of Pharaoh, you will not go forth hence and except your youngest brother come hither. So he really wants him to fetch their brothers. And so he holds one of the brothers hostage. And that brother is going to be Simeon. If you go to verse 24, and they're all weeping and everything, but he takes Simeon and he binds him up and he puts him in some kind of a prison or some kind of a holding cell. And he says, you guys got to go get Benjamin. I want you to go get him. Look at verse 25. So Joseph commanded his guys, his army guys, to fill their sacks with corn and to restore every man's money into his sack and to give them provision for the way, and thus did he unto them. And the notion is this idea that they don't know that they get their money back. They don't know that he's putting it back in their bags. And yet, they're going to find out. In fact, they're going to find out twice, because we're back to the idea of two stories stitched together. But anyways, what's going on? I like verse 25 as they get back what they gave. There's some sweet irony here in the text. They give money for the grain, and Joseph puts the money right back. Notice what it says. As one of them opened his sack to give his donkey provender, this is verse 27, in the inn, he espied his money, for behold, it was in the sack's mouth. And he says, oh my goodness, my money is restored. And everyone freaks out. It says that they were afraid, saying one to another, what is this that God has done to us? And so they weren't expecting it. And they're like, oh, what's going to happen? And I really like this as a story of restoration. It seems to be that Joseph is trying to say, I'm going to give you guys what you gave. Now, Joseph's not going to take it all the way, but he's going to give him a little bit of ribbing here. And this is kind of reminiscent of Alma 41. I think Alma 41 is commentary on this kind of behavior. Just a couple thoughts from Alma 41 here. This is Alma speaking to his son Corianton. And Corianton really struggled with this idea of restoration. And Corianton kind of wanted to live in a world where you can kind of do what you want and God wouldn't really punish you and we'd get restored to happiness because, hey, God really, that wouldn't be very nice, right? If I was put in a situation where I chose wrong and I got evil restored to me. And so there's some really interesting verses in Alma 41 that teach what I call cosmic karma or cosmic justice and how we get what we give. I really like verse 7. These are they that are redeemed of the Lord. Yea, these are they that are taken out and are delivered from the endless night of darkness. And thus they stand or fall, for behold, they are their own judges, whether to do good or to do evil. It seems like Alma is saying this. We really do judge ourselves. And if you want to be in a state of happiness, then you've got to choose those things. Everything, he says in verse 2, is going to be restored to its proper order. He says in verse 1, some have wrested the scriptures and have gone astray because they think that restoration means I can do whatever I want. And Alma says, yeah, not so much. That's not how it's going to play out. So look what he says in verse 14 to his son. He says, my son, see that you are merciful to your brethren, deal justly, judge righteously, and do good continually. And if you do all these things, then you shall receive your reward. And you will have mercy restored to you again. And you will have justice restored to you again. And you will have a righteous judgment restored to you again. And you shall have good rewarded to you again. For that which you send out shall return to you again. That's powerful. I call that cosmic karma. And that's Alma talking about the law of restoration. I can't teach the story of Joseph without at least dipping our bucket in the well of Alma's teaching. And I think Alma's aware of this stuff. He's aware of these stories. The Book of Mormon is continually giving midrash on the biblical narrative. And that's just kind of how I see it. And I see Joseph as he's going to push it a little bit, but he's really pushing these brothers not to necessarily punish them, but I think he wants them, and I think he wants to see where their hearts are. He really wants to see, okay, are you guys the same guys that threw me in that pit? And or sold me to the Ishmaelites / Midianites, depending on which text you read. Are you those same guys? Because if you are, we're going to have some problems. But if you guys have changed, I've got some good news for you guys. So back to the narrative. Genesis 42, Simeon's shut up. They find their money. They freak out. And then we have a second freak out. Why? Two texts. Once again, back to the whole documentary hypothesis. Look at verse 35. It came to pass as they emptied their sacks, behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. It's almost like verse 27 never happened. And when both they and their father saw the bundles of the money, they were afraid. And Jacob, their father, said to them, Me have you bereaved of my children. Joseph is not, and Simeon is not. And you will take Benjamin away? All these things are against me. And so then Reuben has this ultimate plan. He's like, I've got an idea. I'll tell you what. If I can't bring him back, then you know what you can do? Verse 37 of chapter 42 of Genesis. I'll tell you what. You kill my kids. You can kill my boys if I don't deliver. And boy, there's a lot of ink spilled on this in Jewish commentaries. There's a lot of midrash where the rabbis say things like, yeah, that's really not a good plan, Reuben, because guess what? Your sons are his sons. Why would failing to bring back a son lead to the consequence of, hey, let's kill more of your sons? That's probably not the brightest solution. And so in this text that comes to us, Reuben doesn't look really hot. And so Judah's going to come to the rescue. So the 43rd chapter of Genesis is Judah's solution. He's going to fix this. And the brothers are going to take their second trip down into Egypt. And in this trip, things are going to change up. So in Genesis 43, Judah's solution, look what it says in verse 8. Judah said to Israel, his dad, send the lad with me, send Benjamin with me, and we'll arise and go that we may live and not die, both we and thou, and also our little ones. And I will be a surety for him of my hand, shalt thou require him. If I bring him not unto thee and set him before thee, let me bear the blame forever. And so in this instance, Judah steps up and says, you know what, dad, I got this. Blame me if it doesn't work, but I think I can figure this out. There's also some pretty cool punning happening on here in this text of Genesis 43:8, where Judah says, you know what, I'm going to go and I'm going to do this. First of all, think about this idea. And this is pretty, to me, this is fascinating. We have two missing boys. We have Joseph and Simeon. And now we have a possibility to lose a third. And it's Judah who steps up and says, I'll fix it. This is reminiscent of Genesis 38, where Judah has lost two sons. And Tamar, it's almost like she's the bad luck daughter-in-law, right? She wants to marry the third son. And Judah, scared, wants to preserve him. And so he forbids the wedding, which brings about all the interesting things, tragic and or otherwise, happening in Genesis 38. And so in this narrative, we have such a similar circumstance. We have two gone sons with a possibility to lose a third, but this time Judah does the right thing. So that's pretty cool. Then we have verse 9, where he says, I will be a surety. And that word is arav. And that is very similar to the word that's used for pledge when he gives his pledge to Tamar to pay her. And that's what we see in Genesis 38:17. He gives a pledge or a eravon. And so there's this punning going on. When he gives the pledge, the eravon in Genesis 38, it's to do something bad, right? He is prostituting himself. When he gives his pledge or his surety in verse 9, it's to do something good. And so by using these words in the original language, the author of the text is trying to show the change in Judah. And it's fascinating in the language. It's lost in the English translation, but it's beautiful stuff. And so he does. He decides to go down and he takes Benjamin with him. They bring back their money and then they bow. Look in verse 26 of Genesis 43. It says that they bowed themselves to him, to the earth. And he asked them, is your father well? And they said, yeah, he's in really good health. And he lifted up his eyes, verse 29, and saw Benjamin, his mother's son. And he said, is this your younger brother of whom ye spake? And he said, God be gracious unto thee, my son. And then Joseph's going to go. He's going to make haste and he's going to go away and weep because he sees his brother Benjamin for the first time after all these years of separation. And then they set on bread and they're going to sit down and eat. Now, what do you do with verse 32? Genesis 43:32 has puzzled commentators for many, many years. And I'm going to geek out on this for just a minute. I'm going to start and end with my favorite phrase, I don't know. But I think there's something to this. It says, they set on for him by himself, and for them by themselves, and for the Egyptians which did eat with him by themselves. Because the Egyptians might not eat bread with the Hebrews, for that is an abomination unto the Egyptians. And so the author of this verse is trying to say that the Egyptians and the Hebrews don't eat together. And we really don't know why. There's a lot of speculation, and there's a lot of medieval Jewish commentators, rabbis, and so forth, that have said things like, hey, the Egyptians, they didn't eat cow, or the Egyptians didn't eat meat. They were a bunch of vegans. And all of this has been debunked by simple archaeological finds. The Egyptians clearly ate meat. And I have a scholarly paper, if you want to read it, that really kind of breaks down a lot of these ideas that people have had over years of, you know, what to do with verse 32. It's 24 pages, and it's called Abomination to Egyptians in Genesis 43. And it's by this man by the name of Aaron Pinker, and he cites the scholarship, and he cites the medieval rabbinical commentaries, but he gives a couple possibilities. And like I said, we don't know, but I think one of them really does have some traction. Pinker gives us the notion that these Egyptians, especially the high-class ones, those in the upper classes that Joseph is associating with, these people are wearing linen, and the Hebrews are wearing wool. And if you just think about some of the smells and some of those things, you know, a long trip and you're wearing wool and how the sweat clings to it. And so his point is maybe that might have been really a problem. That might have been a problem for these Egyptians. Another one could be the manner in which the Jews sacrificed. And he gets into the weeds in this. And like I said, for those of you that are interested, I'm going to post this. But at the end of the day, we don't know. We don't know what to do with verse 32, but it's definitely in there in the Bible that they're not together. And so this is just Joseph and his bros, and they're eating. And notice what he does in verse 33. He puts them in rank according to birthright, and the youngest according to his youth, it says. And then it says that he set messes unto them from before him, but Benjamin's mess was five times so much as theirs. And they drank and were merry with him. And it doesn't really explain why. I think one of the things that's happening here is Joseph once again is testing them to see how they'll react to Benjamin getting the favored circumstance. But like I said, we don't know. Then we start the 44th chapter of Genesis. And in this chapter, once again, Joseph secretly has their money put back into their bags. He takes a silver cup and he sticks it in Benjamin's sack, and he sends him away in the morning. And he's like, hey, you guys have a great day. And as they're headed back to the land of Canaan, Joseph sends his guys, his soldiers. It says in verse 6, they overtake him and they say, wherefore saith my Lord, God forbid that thy servants should do according to this thing. Behold, the money which we found in our sacks' mouths we brought again unto thee out of the land of Canaan. How then should we steal of thy Lord's house silver or gold? And so he overtakes him, and he's like, what have you guys done? There's a lot going on here that at first glance, you can kind of miss it. So they overtake him, and in verse 4 it says, wherefore have you rewarded evil for good? And verse 5 is a very interesting verse. It says, is not this it in which my Lord drinketh, and whereby indeed he divineth? Ye have done evil in so doing. Later in verse 15, it says, Joseph said to them, what deed is this that ye have done? Wot ye not that such a man as I can certainly divine? And so this is an allusion to the idea that Joseph's silver cup is used for scrying or having visions. And so anciently, one of the thoughts was you could take a cup and you could pour liquid into it, and you could look into the liquid and you could see, as you gaze into it, you could see the future. And the author of this text is showing us that Joseph is a seer, that he is a seer, and that this is one of the ways that he did this. And this cup is really significant. Now, it doesn't pop right out at you in the text, but that's kind of what's going on here. Now, later we learn, especially in the Joseph Smith translation, that Joseph is a seer and that he can see things, and very similar to the prophet Joseph Smith. In other words, he reveals that which is hidden and he can see things that haven't happened yet. In the Joseph Smith translation of Genesis 50, I would encourage you to read verses 24 through 38. In that text of Genesis 50 of the Joseph Smith translation, verses 24 through 38, Joseph makes a lot of prophecies about Joseph in the last days, a choice seer, and how he's going to be the fruit of Joseph of Egypt's loins. And he tells his descendants, Joseph tells his descendants that they're going to be in bondage, but that they're going to be delivered. He does some prophecy concerning the Messiah. All of this is in the Joseph Smith translation of Genesis 50. And so I'm totally at home. I'm okay with Joseph of Egypt using this cup for divinization. I also understand that modern readers can be troubled by this. And I think the King James translators did a really good job in verse 5 and 15 of whitewashing what's really happening here. But this cup is not just an average cup. This is his cup for scrying, and it's in Benjamin's sack. And so Joseph's going to take him. Look what it says at verse 12. He searched and began at the eldest, and he left at the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's. Now, the brothers, when they're doing the search, look in verse 9 of Genesis 44. They say, hey, whoever has the cup, if one of us stole it, then let him die. Well, now they found the cup. And so Judah freaks out. Judah in verse 14 says that he fell down before him on the ground. And Joseph says, you know, what have you done? This is my divining cup, verse 15. Verse 16, Judah says, you know, we'll do anything. We'll do whatever you want. Look what it says. What shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? How shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of thy servants. Behold, we are your servants, both we and also with whom the cup is found. We'll do whatever you want. And then verse 18, Judah gets closer and he says, let me just speak closer to you. And then he says, do you have a father or a brother? We do. We have a dad. He's really old. And our brother's dad, the one that he really liked. We can't leave this boy. Verse 22. If he dies, our dad's going to die. We can't go down. If our younger brother is not with us, this is all for nothing. Verse 29. You're going to bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to the grave. That's what's going to happen to my father. Now, therefore, when I come to thy servant, my father, and the lad isn't with us, seeing that his life is bound up in this lad's life, it's not going to work out. So I love verse 33. This is the proof of Judah's change. Look what he says. Now, therefore, I pray thee, let thy servant abide instead of the lad, a bondman to my Lord, and let the lad go with his brethren. Translation, take me, sir. I will be the person and I will pay with my life. You can take my life. Just take it. Just don't take Benjamin. And so Judah truly has changed. He's a completely different person. And so Joseph in chapter 45 makes himself known to his brothers. And he says, I am Joseph. Now, I really like this as a typological story of Jesus. The first trip down into Egypt, they don't recognize him. The second time, he reveals himself. When Jesus comes to the Jews the first time as a man walking in Galilee and Judea, they crucify him. They don't recognize him. But the second time when he comes, they will know who he is. They will recognize him as the King of Kings. And so this is Joseph, and this is his experience to do everything Alma 41 talks about. This is the law of restoration. But in this circumstance, Joseph is giving them good for evil. I am Joseph. Verse 4, come near. I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. Now therefore, be not grieved, verse 5, nor angry that you sold me hither. For God did send me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years hath the famine been in the land, and yet there's going to be 5 more. God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity in the earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance. And so this is truly who he is. He went down into the pit to save their life. This is Jesus revealing himself to the sons of men. He gave his life to save ours. John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever believeth in him might not perish, but have everlasting life. Verse 11, I will nourish thee. And at verse 18, you will eat the fat of the land. Verse 22, he gives them each changes of raiment. This fits with Pinker's assessment that maybe their raiment was offensive to the Egyptians. He gives them linen raiment and he sends them back. Go get my father. They go back. They go back to Canaan. Verse 26, Joseph is yet alive and he's the governor over all the land of Egypt. And Jacob's heart fainted for he didn't believe him. And they told him all the words of Joseph that he said unto them. And when he saw the wagons which Joseph sent to carry him, the spirit of Jacob their father revived. And Israel said, it is enough. Joseph, my son, is alive. I will go see him before I die. And so this is a beautiful text talking about forgiveness and talking about reunification and how the house of Israel will be saved. And it will be saved in this instance by the covenant son who went down into the depths of the dungeon and was faithful all the way. and was full of mercy to brothers that did not deserve it. If you remember from our last podcast, we talked about the root of Joseph's name means to take away and also to restore. I want to talk about a couple of the things that he takes away. Look in 43, in the 43rd chapter. Look at verse 9, where Judah says, I will be surety for him. Of my hand shalt thou require of him. This is Judah losing his pride. He says, you know what? Take me. This is also Genesis 44:33, where he says, hey, take me. Don't take the lad. Take me. I will do it. Reuben's pride is also taken. If you look in Genesis 42, I know it's kind of a silly promise that he makes, and the Jewish rabbis really beat him up for it. But if you look in verse 37 and 38, Reuben is essentially saying, okay, now, it would have been better if he would have said, take me. But he says, hey, take my sons. This is showing at least a semblance of humility in Reuben's case. All the brothers are truly humbled when they find out that it's Joseph in the 45th chapter. Over and over again, they bow themselves to Joseph. They bow themselves to him in 43 verse 26, and they bow again in 44 14. And we tied this in earlier with the Philippians text, but this is the taking away of their pride. And as they get it stripped away, they get redeemed. Joseph is going to restore them to their greatness. He's going to save their lives. He's going to save their seed, as it were. Now, later, Moses is going to deliver them in the Exodus experience, but they're going to be restored to life in the midst of this famine by going down into Egypt. Joseph is also restoring life to everyone. The author wants to make sure that we read that this famine affected everybody and everyone got bread. And so Joseph both restores and he takes away. Now, if you think about the name Joseph, as in Joseph Smith, he is a restorer, he is a Zaphnath-Paneah, and he is also taking away. He's taking away some of the false traditions that have crept in over 2,000 years of Christian tradition in the apostasy, but he's also restoring or putting back specifically Jesus, his attributes, his characteristics, the ordinances, everything essential to understand the nature of God and the nature of the Father and the covenants. All of this is being restored through the revelations of the restoration, but Joseph also took some things away. And so I see this Joseph of Egypt as also a type for Joseph, as in the Joseph, the final person in the last dispensation of all times to restore truth. So I really like that as well. The 46th chapter is a dream vision from the Elohist narrative in the first four verses. The bulk of this is going to be from the priestly author, a later author. So if you go to verse 6 through 27, it's a bunch of genealogical stuff. A lot of times when you're reading that kind of stuff, we're talking the priestly author. But I really want to hone in and focus on those first four verses of the Elohist in chapter 46. Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in the visions of the night. So he's going to have a vision. And he said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here am I. And he said, I am God, the God of thy father. Fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will make there of thee a great nation. I will go down with thee into Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up again, and Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes. And so that's beautiful stuff. He gets this vision. He's promised that they're going to be okay, and they're going to be made a great nation. And so, like I said, to me, that's the main point. 6 through 27 is the priestly narrative, and you can read that, just a bunch of genealogy, and there's nothing wrong with it. And then 27, 28 to the end is from the Yahwist, and this is essentially them going to the land of Goshen, and they're going to take care of their things, their cattle and so forth. The 47th chapter is going to have the settling of the Israelites in this land. There is some contradiction here because we have these different strains. So if you look in verse 6, it talks about them being in the land of Goshen, but if you do a careful reading and you look in verse 11, it says they're actually in the land of Ramses. They're not the same. Just know those are a couple textual traditions of the narrative about what's happening here. But Jacob is going to live, according to verse 28 of Genesis 47, 147 years. That's how long he's going to live. It says in verse 27, Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions and they multiply. There's a lot of stuff in here. Verse 25, their lives are saved. Verse 26, Joseph makes laws that they should save a fifth. So Joseph has a lot of authority in chapter 47. Some people like to read these verses in the 47th chapter as, you know, the power of the state and look what happens. And, you know, you can read it, but essentially people keep running out of food. And so they keep one-upping things. They say, well, I'm out of food. And Joseph says, well, what do you have? And then they say, well, we're out of money too. And then he's like, okay, well, give me your cattle. So they give him all their cattle, and then they're out of cattle. And then, you know, when the year's over, they come back and they say, we need food. And Joseph's like, well, you don't have cattle. Do you have any, you know, do you have any cars? Do you have any land? I'm just kidding about the cars. And so pretty soon it says that they get all the land. Look at verse 20. Joseph buys all the land for Pharaoh. For the Egyptians sold every man his field because the famine was so bad. So essentially, you know, what happens when things collapse? Well, the government can get pretty powerful. So, you know, you can read it that way. I certainly don't know how to read it. I'm not going to tell you how to read it. But anyway, the bottom line is things are bad. 7 years, the only people that were prepared were the people that listened to Joseph. And so, hey, this is a good way, or a good reading of this is, hey, listen to the prophet. Be prepared. That's probably a good reading of Genesis 47. The 48th chapter is the blessing of the sons. Now it says that he has two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and that's verse 5 of chapter 48. Once again, there's an interesting thing happening here in these verses. 8 through 22 of Genesis 48 is from a different author than 3 through 7, and it's pretty easy to see. One of the reasons why is because he's introduced to them, he sees Ephraim and Manasseh in verse 5, but then in verse 8, look what it says. Israel beheld Joseph's sons, and he says, who are these? And so textual criticism scholars, or those that understand the documentary hypothesis, say, why would he say, whose are these, when we just introduced the sons Ephraim and Manasseh in verse 5? And the answer is, these are two strains of texts. And so 5 through 7 is not the same as 8 through verse 22. And so I'm going to really hone in on 8 through 22, because to me, this northern text of the Elohist is really the essence of what's happening. So notice what happens. He brings his sons. In verse 10, Israel's eyes were dim, and he's going to kiss him and embrace him. So we're back to this narrative of Jacob getting the birthright from Isaac, when there's this embrace and the smelling of the robes, and he puts him between his knees. And notice what it says in verse 13. Joseph took them both, and he put Ephraim in his right hand towards Israel's left hand, and Manasseh towards the left hand towards Israel's right hand. And that's because Manasseh is the older. And Israel stretched out and laid it upon Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's, guiding his hands wittingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph, and he said, God, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac did walk, the God which fed me all my life long this day, the angel which redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads, and let my name be named on them, and the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. And when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on Ephraim, it displeased him. And he held up his father's hand to remove it and put it on Manasseh's head. And Joseph said unto his father, not so, my father, for this is the firstborn. And the father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He shall also become a great people and shall be great. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his seed shall become a multitude of nations. And so the end of verse 20 says, he set Ephraim before Manasseh. And Israel said to Joseph, before I die, God shall be with you and bring you again into the land of your fathers. Now, it's another example in this text of the younger brother getting the birthright. We don't know why. It doesn't really say. But that is the blessing. There'll be a great people. They're going to be delivered out of bondage. And they're going to go to this land. Look what it says in verse 22, the very last verse of Genesis 48. I have given to thee one portion above thy brethren, which I took out of the hand of the Amorite with my sword and with my bow. And so that's the end of 48. And then the rest of 49, all of Genesis 49 is this patriarchal blessing to the tribes, to the descendants of Jacob, of Israel. And some of them are long and some of them are short. I want to draw your attention to the promise given to Judah. We talked about in our Zoom meeting, and it's also in the text, that Judah is going to be the assigned tribe where the scepter shall be, where the kings shall be. Notice what it says. Judah is a lion's whelp, Genesis 49:9. From the prey, my son, thou art gone down. He stooped down. He couched as a lion, and as an old lion, who shall rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet That's a fertility image. Until Shiloh come. And then to him shall the gathering of the people be, binding his foal unto the vine, and his ass's colt unto the choice vine. He washed his garments in wine, and his clothes in the blood of grapes. His eyes shall be red with wine, and his teeth white with milk. Now, there's a lot to unpack with these verses, and we could probably do, well, I couldn't, but somebody could probably do a whole podcast just on these verses to Judah easily for a long time. So I'm going to throw a couple things at you to think about, but you know, there's a lot of ways to read this. So first, look in the footnote. Footnote to verse 10 of Genesis 49. The Hebrew word Shiloh may be a short form of Asherloh, which can be rendered whose right it is. So if you read it that way, look what it says. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until whose right it is comes. Well, who's that? I think that could be Jesus. Other Jewish translators, they give it a spin. They say, hey, maybe this is not Asherloh, but this is Shiloh. And so here's another translation. This is right out of the Jewish Study Bible. You, O Judah, your brother shall praise. Your hand shall be on the nape of your foes. Your father's sons shall bow low to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. On, pray, my son, have you grown? He crouches. He lies like a lion. Like the king of beasts, who will dare rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, so that tribute shall come to him, and the homage of peoples be his. And so this is a prophetic statement that Judah will reign, that he will have the scepter, and that the brothers will bow down to him, and that there will be tribute that will come to him, not till Shiloh come. And so that word Shiloh can be kind of problematic. It can be kind of enigmatic, and I don't have an answer. I have lots of possible readings of the text, and I wanted to keep this podcast to about an hour. And so I just want to leave that with you to consider and to look at and to think about. Probably the last word on this is going to be President Benson. I'm going to give his take on this. And this is right out of the Institute Manual. So if you go to the Institute Manual for the commentary on Genesis 49, 8 through 12, and this is labeled 8-24, this is what it says. The blessings given to Judah indicate that kings would come from his lineage. See 1 Chronicles 5, 1 and 2, Hebrews 7, 14. Old Testament history teaches that this promise was fulfilled. King David and Solomon and Rehoboam are just three of the kings who came from Judah's lineage. The King of Kings, Jesus Christ, is going to be referred to here as Shiloh, also came through this line. So here's the quote from President Benson. Quote, the great blessing to Judah is that the contemplated coming of Shiloh, who would gather his people to him. The great blessing to Judah is that it contemplated the coming of Shiloh, who would gather his people to him. This prophecy concerning Shiloh has been subject to several rabbinic and Christian interpretations and the object of considerable controversy. The interpretation given this passage by, and then he's going to call it the Mormon Church, but I'm going to call it the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, is one based on revelation to modern prophets, not on scholarly commentary. It was revealed to Joseph Smith that Shiloh is the Messiah. And that's a talk given in 1976 by President Benson, a message to Judah from Joseph. And it's in the Ensign, December 1976, page 71. And he's quoting the Joseph Smith translation, Genesis 50, verse 24, which says this, Joseph said to his brethren, I die and I go to my fathers. I go down to my grave with joy. The God of my father Jacob be with you to deliver you out of affliction in the days of your bondage. For the Lord has visited me, and I have obtained a promise of the Lord, that out of the fruit of my loins the Lord God would raise a righteous branch out of my loins and unto thee, whom my father Jacob has named Israel, a prophet, not the Messiah, who is called Shiloh. And this prophet shall deliver my people out of Egypt in the days of thy bondage. And so in that text, in parentheses, Joseph is calling Shiloh the Messiah. He's also prophesying of Moses. That's going to be a deliverer for his descendants. So I like that. I like giving President Benson the last word. There's the promise given to Joseph in the 49th chapter. Verse 22, Joseph is a fruitful bough, even a bough by a well whose branches run over the wall. The archers sorely grieved at him, and they shot him and hated him, and his bow abode in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob, the mighty bull, Abir Yaakov. From thence is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. God being called a mighty bull in verse 24 is reminiscent of, well, if you think about even the symbol for the bull is a symbol for the father, fertility, and it's even the symbol for at our fonts. If you think about it, those oxen are a symbol for God the Father. Even by the God of the Father who shall help thee, and by the Almighty who shall bless thee with the blessings of heaven above, the blessings of the deep that lieth under, the blessings of the breast, and the blessings of the womb. The blessings of thy father have prevailed above the blessings of my progenitors unto the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him that was separated from his brethren. What verse 26 is saying, at least to modern prophets and apostles, is that Joseph's descendants would go over the wall, that this bough or this branch would cross a boundary, and that those descendants would inherit the land of the everlasting hills. And so one of the famous quotes is the one by Orson Pratt, where he says, this was fulfilled when Joseph's descendants traversed the oceans and inhabited the Americas or the American continent. And so that's pretty cool stuff going on right there in the 48th chapter. And there's so much more, but we're trying to keep this tight. The 50th chapter is, you just got to read it. But this is where Joseph's going to say goodbye. And he has them promise that his bones will be taken out of Egypt and brought back to the land of his forefathers. Look what it says in verse 5. Lo, I die. In my grave, which I have digged for me in the land of Canaan, there shalt thou bury me. Now, therefore, go up, I pray thee, and bury my father, and I will come again. And so Joseph, in verses 7 through 10, they go back to the land of Canaan and they bury their father. It says right there in verse 10, they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond Jordan. And there they mourned with a great and sore lamentation. And he made a mourning for his father 7 days. And when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning in the floor of Atad, they said, this is a grievous mourning to the Egyptians. And so he and his sons, they carry him into the land of Canaan and they bury him in a place in verse 13 called, this may sound familiar to you, the cave of the field of Machpelah, which Abraham bought with the field for possession of a burying place of Ephron the Hittite before Mamre. And if you remember, Abraham was promised all this land, and even Joseph, he's second in command of the greatest empire in this text, and they go and they bury his father in this cave. And so the promise still isn't fulfilled. Even though Joseph has this power, the seeds of the fulfillment of the promise are there, but the promise is not fulfilled yet. And so Genesis ends. It ends with this death of Jacob and Joseph, verse 14, returning to Egypt. After the father dies, the brothers are now worried because they're thinking, okay, dad's dead. Now the brother, now Joseph can show us who he really is. Now he can do whatever he wants. He has all power. And look what it says in Genesis 50. His brethren went in verse 18 and they fell down before his face. So now they bow again. They've lost their humility or they've lost their pride. They bow down again because they've given up their pride. And they said, behold, we will be your servants. And Joseph said, fear not, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good to bring to pass as it is this day to save much people alive. Now therefore, fear not. I will nourish you and your little ones. And he comforted them and spake kindly to them. And so it ends with Joseph giving forgiveness. Even when he has all power, he uses it for good. And so the author of Genesis 50 says that Joseph sees Ephraim's children to the third generation. And then in verse 24, he's about to die. And he said, God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land unto the land which he swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then in verse 25, Joseph makes him promise, take my bones out of here. When you guys depart, take them out. And I want to be buried back with my family. And then Joseph dies, it says in verse 26, being 110 years old. And they embalmed him. And he was put in a coffin in Egypt. And that's the end of Genesis. It ends with Joseph's death and that promise that they will get the land. And that's going to happen in Exodus and also in Joshua. And so I just want to end with my testimony of a couple of things that are kind of hidden, and you kind of got to blow the sand off the text, as it were, to see it. But one of them is this idea of resurrection. If there was no belief in resurrection, why would it matter where his bones are buried? I think it's not in your face like it is in the Book of Mormon, but I think the end of the Genesis narrative is this testimony that there is a resurrection. And it's also, to me, a testimony of Christ, that Joseph fits this bill. He fits this type, that he represents the Savior, and he gives forgiveness to his brothers even when he has all this power. And so I really love the book of Genesis. And once again, like we started off at the beginning of the podcast, Genesis is about beginnings. And so we have the beginning of the house of Israel, the beginning of mankind, and all kinds of stories and lessons about what matters in life, things that show us what brings chaos and what brings order, and how we can take the text and apply it to our life so that we can have order in our life and peace and happiness. And my testimony is that as we do these things and as we come into Jesus, we will have his Spirit to be with us. We'll be better people than we would have been, and that he'll take us home. And I leave that with you in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.